Sunlight crests the Earth's surface. As rays of light shoot up from the continents, the planet spins into view with a word across it: Universal. A web address appears: www.universalstudios.com. In darkness, a drop of blood hangs from above, then falls, sending out ripples. A word forms from the light, glinting off the red rippling surface, and another word appears beneath. Imagine Entertainment. Black bars slash across a green screen, some of them ushering in snippets of white words, until the entire picture is black and full titles appear one at a time. Universal Pictures and Imagine Entertainment present Psycho. The word grows jagged as the snippets get out of sync. Then it splits apart from top to bottom, dragging vertical bars of green behind it. Starring Vince Vaughn. More vertical bars coming from above and below push the title apart, then retract to bring in new ones. Julianne Moore. Viggo Mortensen. William H. Macy. Horizontal bars gradually fill the screen, then disappear as the next titles slide in. With Chad Everett, Rance Howard, Philip Baker Hall, James LeGros, Anne Haney, James Remar, Rita Wilson, and Anne Heche as Marion Crane, the title cleaves apart and slides off screen to the left and right. Casting by Howard Feuer. More horizontal bars and lines of words slice in and out. Music by Bernard Herrmann. Music produced and adapted by Danny Elfman and Steve Bartek. Costume designer, Beatrix Aruna Pastor. Editor, Amy E. Duddleston. Production designer, Tom Foden. Director of photography, Christopher Doyle, HKSC. Executive producer, Danny Wolf. Produced by Brian Grazer and Gus Van Zandt. Screenplay by Joseph Stefano. Directed by Gus Van Zandt. The word grows jagged as the snippets get out of sync, then it splits apart from top to bottom. Two halves of an image slide in from opposite sides of the screen to form an aerial view of a city. The hovering perspective floats down around a skyscraper with a central concrete stem connecting three glass panel towers of varying heights. Text flies in from either side, Phoenix, Arizona. Closer to the ground, on one of the city's orderly grid pattern blocks, stands a 16-story high-rise capped with an antenna tower. More words fly in, Friday, December the 11th, 1998. The aerial view flies lower toward the boxy sun-blanched high-rise, 2:43 p.m. Faded lettering on the front awning reads, "The Westward Ho." Air conditioning units poke out from most of the curtainless windows. One of the windows, without a unit, has its Venetian blinds hanging most of the way down. A narrow gap to the sill offers a peep into the room. The voyeuristic view drifts under the blinds and passes inside, where a couple lies stretched out on the mussed bed. The woman wears an orange bra and pink half-slip, while the man is naked apart from a corner of the bedsheet draped over his groin. They snuggle closer together. While he strokes her blonde pixie-cut hair, she grazes her painted nails down his arm and gives it a kiss.
You're ready at your lunch, did you?
A fly lands on a sandwich.
Oh, I better get back to the office. These extended lunch hours give my boss excess acid.
Why don't you call your boss and tell him to take the rest of the afternoon off? It's Friday, anyway.
Huh? Yeah, what do I do with my free afternoon? Walk you to the airport?
Lays around here a while longer.
Checking out time is 3 p.m. Hotels of this sort aren't interested in when you come in, but when your time's up... I hate having to be with you in a place like this. I have to go.
As she sits up to collect her clothes, he drapes an arm around her shoulder from behind.
And come down next week?
No.
I didn't just see you. Have lunch? In public?
Oh, we can see each other. We can have dinner. But respectably.
He removes her bra strap and she pulls it back up.
In my house, with my mother's picture on the mantle, my sister helping me to broil a steak for three.
Yeah, I kind of like to meet your sister. She look anything like you?
Sam.
All right. Marion, whenever possible, I want to see you. And under any conditions, even respectability.
You make respectability sound so disrespectful.
No, I'm all for it. Look, a couple of years I have my father's debts paid off at the store. And told you, alimony stops as soon as she gets married again.
Oh. I haven't even been married once yet.
Yeah, but when you do, you'll swing.
So let's get married.
You really want to live in the back room of the hardware store in Fairvale? Eat beans out of a can with me?
Oh.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of laughs. Tell you what, when I send my ex-wife her money...
He raises the blinds.
You can lick the stamps.
I'll lick the stamps.
She puts in her earrings.
Hey, Marion, you want to cut this off? Go out and find yourself someone who's available?
I'm thinking of it.
Don't you go break my heart now.
Marion gives him a kiss on her way out.
Don't miss your plane.
Hey, wait. We can leave together, can't we?
I'm late. And you have to put your shoes on.
She leaves her naked beau behind. Now she enters a real estate office past a man being chewed out by a jowly gentleman in a cowboy hat.
Is Mr. Lowry back from lunch yet?
He's lunching with the man who's buying the Harris Street property.
Oh,
you know,
right.
The oil lease man?
Right.
So that's why he's late.
Marion nurses her forehead.
You getting a headache?
It'll pass. Headaches are like resolutions. You forget about them as soon as they stop hurting.
You got aspirins? I have something. Not aspirins. But my mother's doctor gave these to me on the day of my wedding. Teddy was furious when he found out I'd taken tranquilizers.
Any calls?
Oh, Teddy called me. And my mother called to see if Teddy called. And, oh, your sister called to say that she'd be going to Tucson to do some buying and she'd be gone the whole weekend. And
two men enter the office.
Hot as fresh milk. You girls ought to get your boss to turn on the air conditioning. You can afford it today.
Marion, will you get those copies of the deed ready for Mr. Cassidy?
Of course.
Tomorrow's the day. My sweet little girl.
Marion frowns bemusedly.
Not you, darling. My daughter. She's a baby, but tomorrow she stands up there and gets herself married away from me. Yeah, I'd like to have a look at my baby.
He shows her a photo.
18 years old and never known an unhappy day in any one of those years.
Come on, Tom. Air conditioner's on in my office.
You know what I do with unhappiness? I buy it off. You unhappy?
Oh, not inordinately, no.
You know, buying this house is a wedding present for my baby. Now, that's not buying happiness. That's buying off unhappiness. See? Yes, sir.
He pulls out money.
$400,000 cash. Not to worry now. I'll never carry more than I can afford to lose. Count them up.
I declare.
I don't. So I'm able to keep it.
Tom, cash transactions of this size, most irregular.
Yeah, so what? It's my private money, now it's yours.
Suppose we just put this in the safe and then Monday morning when you're feeling good.
Well, speaking of feeling good, what happened to that bottle you said you had in your desk?
He covers his mouth naughtily, then leans in closer to Marion.
You know, sometimes I can't keep my mouth shut.
As he leaves her desk, her playful smile becomes a disgusted frown.
Lowry, I'm dying of thirst to ruin it here.
Marion's boss turns to her.
I don't even want it in the office over the weekend. Put it in the safe deposit box at the bank, Marion, and we'll get him to give us a check on Monday instead.
Okay.
The married secretary comes over and fans through one of the bundles of cash, pretending to cool herself with it. Marion takes it from her.
He was flirting with you.
She stuffs it in an envelope.
I guess he must have noticed my wedding ring.
Grinning, Marion collects her purse. She stuffs the envelope inside, then picks up a file folder and goes to her boss's glass-doored private office.
Come in.
Cassidy looks up from his drink as she enters.
The copies?
Thank you.
Mr. Lowry, if you don't mind, I'd like to go right on home after the bank. I'm feeling a slight...
You go ahead on over. Me and your boss are going to go out and get ourselves a little drinking done, right?
Of course. Do you feel ill?
Oh, it's just a little headache.
Need a weekend in Las Vegas. Playground of the world.
I'm going to spend the weekend in bed. Thank you.
Only playground to beat Las Vegas.
As Marion goes back into the outer office and slides the door shut, the image dissolves to a view of her bedroom. She steps inside her open closet, wearing a gold bra and a green half-slip. On the other side of her bed lies the envelope containing the two bundles of cash, with one of its $1,000 bills peeking out from behind the rumpled flap. A haphazardly packed overnight suitcase sits open nearby. Marion takes a dress from the closet and eyes the envelope of money as she puts it on. She packs some final items into her suitcase. Nursing her head, she goes to a mirror and examines her pale, nervous face. Grabbing a handbag, she turns back to her bed and continues packing. She retrieves something from a drawer. Opening a small file envelope, she briefly peruses its contents of official documents, including her passport and a certificate of stock shares. As she zips her suitcase shut, her eyes fall upon the envelope of money. Coming around the foot of the bed with her handbag, she takes a seat beside the loot. As she pauses to deliberate, a bird lands on a tree branch outside. Marion stuffs the money-filled envelope in her handbag. Springing back to her feet, she slides the handles up her forearm and picks up the suitcase with her other hand. She pulls a coat off a hanger, shuts the closet, and leaves the room. Later, she drives her car through town with a tense expression on her face.
Marion, what are you doing up here? Where in the world did you get all that money? Yeah, it's more than I need to get out of debt.
She stops at an intersection. Lowry and Cassidy cross the street right in front of her car.
Sandy, you see anything there you haven't at least had a fifth of before? Sandy looks all up and down.
Her boss pauses and looks back at her.
Sandy looks all up and down the park.
As Cassidy drags him along, Marion accelerates across the intersection. Her nervous face fades away into a view of her car disappearing up a desert road toward an ominously darkening sky. At night, she blinks against the glare of oncoming headlights. As she lets her eyes close for a moment, the picture fades to black. In the morning, Marion's car sits stopped on the side of the road, alone in a landscape of sagebrush and fenced-off hills. A police cruiser drives past it, then comes to an abrupt stop, reverses, and slides in behind the car on the dusty shoulder. A highway patrolman gets out. Looking into Marion's car, he sees her stretched out across the front seat, asleep. He wraps his knuckles on the window. Stirring awake, Marion sees the patrolman and sits up with a start. She hurriedly turns the ignition.
Hold it right there.
The patrolman gestures to her window, and she lowers it.
In quite a hurry.
Yes, I didn't intend to sleep so long. Well, I almost had an accident last night from sleepiness, so I decided to pull over.
You slept here all night?
Yes. As I said, I couldn't keep my eyes open. So.
There are plenty of motels in this area. You should have... I mean, just to be safe.
I just pulled over. Have I broken any laws?
No, ma'am.
Then I'm free to go?
Is anything wrong?
There's nothing wrong, except that I'm in a hurry and you're taking up my time.
Now, just a moment. Turn your motor off, please.
Marion heaves a sigh before complying.
May I see your license and registration?
Why?
Please.
Turning her shoulder slightly to block his view, she moves around the money-filled envelope and the small file envelope of important documents to get to her wallet inside her handbag. Opening it, she finally hands him her license, along with her registration. The patrolman walks around to the front of the car and checks the Arizona license plate, ANL-709. He returns Marion's license and registration.
Have a nice day.
She raises her window as he heads back to his own car. She stuffs her things back in her handbag before starting up again. As she drives ahead, unnerved, the patrolman follows in his automobile. Clutching the steering wheel tightly in both hands, Marion eyes the winding high desert road in front of her, then glances into her rearview mirror. The patrol car keeps behind her at match speed. Marion nervously follows a directional sign for a freeway. She checks her mirror again. The patrol car is still following. Marion knits her brow and keeps going at a modest speed, keeping to the right lane. Her eyes stay glued to the road for a few moments, but eventually peel away to confirm that the patrolman is still on her tail. As he finally takes an exit off the freeway, she relaxes. She glances back at the highway patrol car moving off on its parallel road. The image dissolves to a view from her windshield as she cruises down a street in a small town. Wearing orange-tinted sunglasses, Marion looks around, still shooting the occasional glance over her shoulder. She pulls into a lot with signs and banners reading, "Cash for Cars, Quality Auto, Buy, Sell, Trade, Best Terms, Trade-ins Welcome." Marion gets out with her handbag and opens a parasol. A man wearing a necktie leans out from an office. Marion nods, then steps around the front of her sedan in her pastel-colored sundress. Walking along a line of used cars for sale, she takes notice of all their California plates. Something catches her eye. Stepping forward briskly, she pulls her wallet from her purse, goes to a newspaper stand on the corner, and drops a coin in the slot. The highway patrolman slows to a stop on the road and eyes her. He makes a U-turn to the other side of the street. Engrossed in her copy of the Los Angeles Times, Marion doesn't notice.
I'm in no mood for trouble.
What?
There's an old saying that the first customer of the day is always the most trouble. Like I said, I'm in no mood for it, so I'm just going to treat you so fair and square that you're not going to have one human reason.
Can I trade in my car and take another?
Well, you can do anything you have a mind to. Being a woman, you will. Is that yours?
Yes, yes. There's nothing wrong with it. I'm just...
sick of the sight of it. Well, why don't you have a look around? See if there's anything that strikes your eye? Meanwhile, I'll have my mechanic give yours a once-over. I was just about to make some coffee. You want some?
No, I'm in a hurry. I just want to make the change and start.
That's one thing a person ought not to be, is in a hurry. But like I said, it's too nice a day to argue. So I'll just shoot your car in the garage. Oh, babe!
She sees the patrolman. A mechanic comes out to the car dealer.
What's up?
Yeah, can you take this one and give it a once-over, check it out?
Oh, yeah, sure, no problem.
Stuffing her newspaper in her bag, Marion looks at a car.
Say, that's the one I'd have picked for you myself.
How much?
Go ahead, spin it around.
Oh, no, it looks fine. How much will it be with my car?
You mean you don't want the usual day and a half to think it over?
Nope.
You are in a hurry. Somebody chasing you?
Of course not. Please.
Well, it's the first time I ever saw the customer high-pressure the salesman. But I figure, roughly, your car plus 4,000?
4,000.
4,000. You got time to argue price, though, huh?
All right. $4,000.
I take it, you can prove that car is yours. I mean, out-of-state license and all.
I think I have all the necessary papers, yes. Is there a ladies' room?
In the building.
As he walks her over to it, she shoots another glance in the direction of the patrolman still watching her intently. Entering the ladies' room, Marion shuts the door behind her and retrieves the envelope of money from her handbag. She removes a rubber band holding it closed, takes out the bundles of $1,000 bills, and counts out four of them. The patrolman turns across the street and drives onto the lot. Pulling past Marion's new car, he comes to a stop and climbs out. She strides from the office with the dealer. Seeing the patrolman standing by his cruiser, she stops in her tracks, then hurries to her new 89 model car. The dealer opens the door for her. She brakes hard and looks back.
Got your back.
The mechanic comes over from her old car.
Put him in the back, please.
He throws her suitcase and coat in the back seat. The car dealer peels the 89 sticker off her windshield. As she zooms off, the three men all stare after her.
Heck, officer. That was the first time I ever saw the customer high-pressure the salesman. Somebody chasing her?
I better have a look at those papers, Charlie.
She looked like a bad one to you?
Acted like one.
Funny thing is, she paid me in cash.
Marion removes her sunglasses to look out at the clear highway ahead.
Yes, Mr. Lowry?
Caroline? Marion still isn't in?
No, Mr. Lowry. But then she's always a bit late on Monday mornings.
Must be a minute she comes in.
No, Mr. Lowry.
Call her sister. If no one's answering in the house.
I called her sister, Mr. Lowry, where she works, hardcore vinyl record store, you know.
Call her sister.
And she doesn't know where Marion is any more than we do.
You better run out to the house. She may be unable to answer the phone.
Call her sister. Her sister's going to do that. She's as worried as we are.
The oncoming cars now have their headlights on.
No, I haven't the faintest idea. As I said, I last saw your sister when she left this office on Friday. She said she didn't feel well and wanted to leave early, and I said she could. And that was the last I saw. Wait a minute. I did see her sometime later. Driving. I think you better come over here to my office. Quick. Caroline, quick. Get Mr. Cassidy for me. Driving. Quick.
Playing about to kiss off $400,000. I'll get it back, and if any of it's missing, I'll replace it with her fine, soft flesh. I'll track her whenever you doubt it.
Hold on, Cassidy. A girl works for you for 10 years, you trust her. It must be some kind of a mystery. I can't.
Check with the bank, no? They never laid eyes on her, no? You still trust him? Hot creepers, man. She sat there while I dumped it out, hardly even looked at it. Planning and even flirting with me.
A smile creeps across Marion's lips. Big drops of rain splat against her windshield. She searches her steering column and turns on the wipers. Through the sheets of water, oncoming headlights appear as rapidly approaching blurs. Blinking and squinting, Marion struggles to see the road ahead through the now torrential rain. Diffused headlights streak across her blue eyes. The last of the oncoming cars drives by. Marion looks around the highway. All she can see outside her windshield is blackness and rain. She slows down on the highway, following the dotted lane marker line and the few yards of visibility afforded by her headlights. A neon motel sign in the distance catches her eye. Blurred by the streaks on her windshield, she sees another illuminated sign beyond a tree. Peering at it, Marion draws up slowly to read the vertical and horizontal letters spelling Bates Motel. The word vacancy is illuminated underneath. Marion eyes the front porch under the giant red neon motel sign, where another neon sign over the corner unit reads Office. Stopping, Marion slides across her front seats. She opens the passenger side door and dashes out to the covered porch. Going into the office, she finds the front desk vacant and checks a doorway to another room in back. Looking around curiously, she goes back out onto the porch and peers around the corner. A large old house stands at the top of a hill. In one of the upstairs rooms, a woman's silhouette passes a lighted window. Marion dashes back to her car, gets in from the passenger side, and honks the horn. There's no movement at the house. The front door opens, and a figure comes out, heading down a set of stairs. Marion sits back in her seat, the Bates Motel sign reflected backwards and warped in her driver's window. She watches the tall, shadowy man make his way down with an umbrella to meet her on the porch.
Gee, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you in all this rain. Go on in, please.
He follows her into the office and heads behind the front desk.
It's a dirty night.
Do you have a vacancy?
Oh, we have 12, in fact. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies. They moved away the highway.
Oh, I thought I had gotten off the main road.
I knew you must have. No one ever stops here anymore unless they've done that.
He opens a registration book. He gets Marion a pen.
But it's no use in dwelling on our losses. No, we just keep on lighting the lights and following the formalities.
She writes the name Marie Samuels.
Your home address. Time will do.
She glances at the newspaper sticking out of her handbag.
Los Angeles.
The young clerk considers all the room keys hanging up on a board, then removes the first one.
Cabin one. It's closer in case you want anything. I'm right next to the office.
Oh, I want sleep more than anything else. Except maybe food.
There's a big diner about 10 miles up the road, just outside Fairvale.
Am I that close to Fairvale?
15 miles. I'll get your bags for you.
He heads out the door, and Marion follows. She waits on the covered porch as he goes to her car and retrieves her suitcase and overcoat. Heading to the first motel room from the office, he unlocks the door. He pushes it open for Marion to go inside ahead of him, then switches on the lights and sets down her things.
Stuffy in here.
He walks to a back set of windows and cracks them open, then turns to her with a friendly smile.
Well, the mattress is soft, and there's hangers in the closet, and there's stationery with Bates Motel written on it, just in case you want to make your friends back home envious.
He turns a light on in the bathroom.
Over there.
The bathroom.
Mm-hmm. If you want anything at all, just tap on the wall, because I'll be in the office.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bates.
Norman Bates. You know, you have something that most girls don't have.
I have.
And there's not a name for it, but it's something that puts a person at ease.
Well, thank you again.
You're not really going to go out again and drive up to that diner, are you?
No.
Would you do me a favor, then? Would you have dinner with me? I was just about to myself on nothing special, just sandwiches and milk, but I'd like it very much if you came up to the house. I don't set a fancy table or anything, but kitchen's awful homey.
I'd like to.
All right. Well, then you get settled in and take off your wet shoes, and I'll be back as soon as it's ready with my trusty umbrella.
He spins out of the room, pulling the door shut behind him. Marion hoists her suitcase up on the bed, opens it, and takes out a green silk robe. She goes to hang it up, then pauses and glances back. Dropping the dress back down in the suitcase, she pulls over her handbag and takes out the money-filled envelope. She looks about the room. Opening a dresser drawer, she looks into it, then closes it again. She goes to a vanity table and opens one of the top drawers, then reconsiders. Moving to the nightstand, she opens its drawer, but again demurs. As she returns to the suitcase, the newspaper in her handbag catches her eye. She pulls it out and folds it open, then removes the rubber band from around the envelope and takes out its two bundles of cash. Laying them side by side on the open newspaper, she folds it up again precisely to keep them concealed within. She places the folded newspaper on the nightstand.
Or my son. Or do I have to tell her because you don't have the guts?
Shut up!
Shut up! Shut up!
Marion listens at the open window. Looking out through the subsiding rain, she sees Norman exiting the house. He wends his way down the stairs carrying a tray. Marion returns to a suitcase and unpacks a pair of shoes, which she puts on while stealing glances at the window. She goes to the door and opens it. Stepping out onto the porch, she waits. Norman comes around the building with a tray of food, pausing as he sees her, then closes the gap between them with a painfully shy look on his face.
I've caused you some trouble.
No, mother. My mother. I was afraid, so. She isn't quite herself today.
Well, you shouldn't have bothered. I really don't have that much of an appetite.
I'm sorry. I wish you could apologize for other people.
Don't worry about it. Well, as long as you fixed us supper, we might as well eat it, huh?
She takes a step back to allow him into her room. Norman starts forward, then hesitates and backpedals to where he was standing, his eyes lifting to the dainty woman poised before him.
It might be nicer and warmer in the office.
He turns and goes inside it, shooting her a boyish smile. Marion watches bemusedly, then closes the door to her room and follows him. Norman waits inside with the tray still in his hands.
It stopped raining.
Eating in an office is just too officious. I have the parlor back here.
Right.
Walking into a darkened back room, he sets down the tray, turns on a lamp, and straightens up a little. Marion comes to the doorway and pauses. The room's stark light illuminates stuffed birds mounted on the walls, their shadows stretched long behind them.
Sit down.
Unfolding her arms, Marion walks around to a chair and turns to face Norman. They both sit down at the same time, with the tray of food on the coffee table between them.
Thank you. You're very kind.
Oh, it's all for you.
He turns it to her.
Go ahead. I'm not hungry.
He gazes at her as she picks up a tiny piece of fruit with her fingers and nibbles on it.
He eat like a bird.
You would know, of course.
Not really. Anyway, I hear that the expression, eats like a bird, is really a falsity, because birds really eat a tremendous lot. I don't really know anything about birds. My hobby is stuffing things. You know, taxidermy. I guess I'd rather stuff birds. Well, because I hate the look of beasts when they're stuffed, you know? Foxes and chimps. Some people even stuff dogs and cats. I couldn't do that. No, I think only birds look well stuffed because they're kind of passive to begin with.
That's a strange hobby. Curious.
It's uncommon, too.
I imagine so.
It's not as expensive as you think. Cheap, really. Needles, thread, sawdust. Chemicals are the only thing that costs anything.
A man should have a hobby.
Oh, it's more than a hobby. A hobby's supposed to pass your time, not fill it.
Is your time so empty?
No. I run the office, tend the cabins, grounds, do little errands for my mother. The ones she allows, I might be capable of doing.
Don't you go out with friends?
A boy's best friend's his mother.
Marion puts a sandwich down on the plate without taking a bite.
You haven't had an empty moment your entire life, have you?
Only my share.
Where are you going? I didn't mean to pry.
I'm looking for a private island.
What are you running away from?
Why do you ask that?
No. People never run away from anything.
She looks thoughtfully at him as he wrings his hands.
Rain didn't last long, did it? You know what I think? I think we're all in our private traps, clamped in them. We can never get out. Always scratch and claw, but only at the ear. Only at each other. And for all of it, we never budge an inch.
Sometimes we deliberately step into those traps.
I was born to mine. But I don't mind it anymore.
Well, you should. You should mind.
I do. I say that I don't.
You know, if anyone ever spoke to me the way I heard, the way she talked to you...
His face grows dark.
Sometimes when she talks to me like that, I feel like I could curse her out and leave her forever. Or at least defy her. Well, I know I can't. She's ill.
She sounded strong.
Oh, no. I mean ill. She had to raise me all by herself after my father died. I was only 5. Must have been quite a strain for her. It's not like she had to go to work or anything like that. He left her a little money. Anyway, a few years ago, Mother met this man. He talked into building this motel. He could have talked her into anything. And when he died, too, it was just too great of a shock for her in the way that he died. Yeah, I guess it's nothing you should be talking about when you're eating. But anyway, it was just too great of a loss for her. And she had nothing left.
Except you.
A son's a poor substitute for a lover.
Why don't you go away?
To a private island like you?
No, no, not like me. Just...
I couldn't do that. Who'd take care of her? She'd be all alone up there. Fire'd go out. Be cold, damp. Like a grave. If you love someone, you can't do that to them. Even if you hate them.
Seeing Marion's frown, he smiles.
Understand. I don't hate her. I hate what she's become. I hate the illness.
Well, wouldn't it be better if you put her someplace?
Do you mean an institution? A madhouse?
Norman sits forward with a cold look in his eyes.
People always call a madhouse someplace, don't they? Put her in someplace.
I didn't mean to sound uncaring.
What do you know about caring? Have you ever seen the inside of one of those places? The laughing and the tears and the cruel eyes studying you? My mother in there? But she's harmless. She's as harmless as one of these stuffed birds.
I am sorry. I only felt
You felt what?
It seemed that she was... She's hurting you. I meant well.
People always mean well. They cluck their thick tongues, and they shake their heads, and they suggest, oh, so very delicately.
Marion shifts her gaze uncomfortably. Norman fidgets in his chair, his expression growing sheepish.
Of course, I've suggested it myself. I hate to think about it. She needs me. It's not as if she were a maniac or a raving thing. She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes. Haven't you?
Yes. Sometimes only one time can be enough. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Norman.
He flashes a grin.
Norman.
She rises.
You're not going back to your room already.
Oh, I'm very tired, and I have a very long drive tomorrow all the way back to Phoenix.
Really?
I stepped into a private trap back there, and I'd like to go and try to pull myself out of it. Before it's too late for me, too.
Well, you sure don't want to stay just a little while longer? Just for talk?
Well, I'd like to. But...
All right. I'll see you in the morning. I'll bring you some breakfast. What time?
Very early. Dawn.
All right. Miss,
Crane.
Crane. That's it.
Good night.
She leaves the parlor. Norman stands up to watch her as she crosses the small office and disappears around the corner onto the porch. He pops a piece of candy in his mouth. Going into the office, he looks at her entry in the registration book, Marie Samuels from Los Angeles. A knowing smile flickers across his face as he sets it back down. Then he returns to the parlor and closes the door with a troubled expression. He goes to the wall bordering Marion's room and stands there in the shadows among his taxidermied birds, listening. His eyes shifting impassively around the room, he leans his ear a little closer. He turns to face a picture hanging on the wall. Lifting it away, he reveals a gouge in the drywall leading to a tiny circle of light. He leans in close, the light hitting his face, and peeps through it to watch Marion strip down to her underwear, unhook her bra, and remove it before stepping out of view. His eye remains laser-focused through the peephole. Marion puts on her Greek silk robe, then removes some jewelry and sets it on the dresser before stepping out of view again. Norman's whole body shakes as he peeps on her. His eye glazes over. He looks down to his pants. Standing under the stuffed and mounted birds, he picks up the painting and rehangs it precisely over the hole in the wall. He turns away with a disturbed look in his eyes, then glances sharply in the direction of his house on the hill. Hastening out of the parlor, he goes through the office and out onto the porch, pausing in the open doorway, then turns his head in the direction of the house. With a scowl, he proceeds around the corner. He jogs up a long, jagged staircase toward the big house at the top of the hill, the lights in the upstairs bedroom windows and the front entryway glowing ominously in the night. Opening the tall, arched front door, he enters the dim foyer. He pauses on the first step of the carpeted stairway, looking up at the top. Shoulders slumped, he swings around the ornamental pinecone banister and bypasses the stairs to head down a hall. He passes through a screen door into the kitchen, drops wearily into a chair, and takes an apple from the table. His tall frame hunches over with it cradled in his lap. Meanwhile, in her motel room, Marion sits at a desk, writing in a notebook. She runs a calculation, subtracting $4,036 from $400,000, then adds $897.65. Tearing the page out of the notebook, she rips it into small pieces, then looks around the floor and pauses with the scraps clutched in her fist. Rising from the desk, she goes into the bathroom. She dumps the scraps of paper in the toilet bowl, flushes them down the drain, and closes the lid, then shuts the bathroom door. Dropping her robe on the toilet and kicking off her shoes, she steps into the tub and draws the plastic curtain shut, which has a frosted prismatic pattern. She turns on the water, then activates the shower head, letting it soak her skin and short blonde hair. Ribbons of water spray down evenly from the octagonal fixture. Marion washes her shoulders and arms. With her eyes closed, she turns and tips her head back into the stream. She tilts her head from side to side, luxuriating in the cleansing water. standing in profile against the white tile wall, she runs the bar of soap up and down her right arm. Behind her back, visible through the translucent curtain, the shape of the bathroom door can be seen opening. A woman's silhouette looms closer, yanks the curtain aside, and brandishes a knife. It slashes downward. Marion's naked body flails defensively. She clutches the attacker's wrist. The knife stabs relentlessly. Marion is rocked by the blows. Blood begins to stain the water at her feet. Storm clouds roll across the sky. The blade glints against the flesh of Marion's midriff. She turns away, hugging the tile wall. Her attacker finally withdraws the knife. Marion's hand plants against the blank white tiles. She turns her back to the wall, one of her pupils dilating as she watches her attacker walk out the doorway and exit. She slumps slowly toward the tub, leaving a streak of blood behind her on the tile. Eyes dulled, she reaches out a hand. It takes hold of the edge of the shower curtain. The weight of her naked body tears it off its rings as she flops unceremoniously over the rim of the tub, blood seeping from cuts on her back. The cascade of water sprays unabated from the octagonal showerhead, emanating from Marion's legs, running in dark spurts along the porcelain tub. Small threads of blood wash toward the drain and spiral their way down the circular orifice. The orb becomes a wide-open eye with a shrinking pupil. Droplets of water cling suspended to Marion's face as it spirals into full view. With her body lying half out of the tub, her left cheek and gaping mouth hug the wet tile floor, hair matted to her head, eyes left open in a blank expression. Away from the body, past her robe draping from the toilet, the door remains open to the room with its neatly made bed and combination wood-paneled and cement brick wall. Under a glowing table lamp, the newspaper lies meticulously folded on the nightstand. Around the corner, the window looks up to the house on the hill, backlit against the cloudy sky. Norman emerges from the front door and dashes down the steps toward the motel. His face ripe with panic, he runs to the porch. Bursting into Marion's room, he goes to the bathroom doorway and looks in, then turns away around the corner and clamps a hand over his mouth. His shoulder knocks a painting of a bird off the wall to the floor. Withdrawing his hand from his mouth, his eyes moist with tears, crosses deliberately to the window. He closes it, then shuts the drapes and sinks onto the edge of the bed. Standing back up, he walks around the bed to the cabin door and closes it, then switches off the lights. Norman goes out onto the porch, closing the door behind him. With a distressed look in his eyes, he crosses to a support post and holds onto it. He looks back over his shoulder toward the motel room. Suddenly turning the other way, he enters his office, swings the door shut, and switches off all the lights on the motel sign and the front porch. He re-emerges, carrying a mop and pail, and slinks over to cabin number one. Going in, he closes the door behind him and pauses deliberatively in the dark. Norman trudges with a portentous bearing to the bathroom. Stepping around the open door, he sets his pail on the floor. Straightening again, he takes a step back and stares down at the body. He turns off the water. He carefully extracts the shower curtain from underneath Marion's outstretched hand, causing the dead woman's arm to flop limply onto the tiles among streaks and pools of blood. Bringing the curtain to the doorway, he lays it on the salmon-covered, shag-carpeted bedroom floor. He gets down on his hands and knees to spread it out to the threshold of the bathroom. Standing up again, he turns back inside and hunches over the body. He slowly pulls it out of the tub by its wrists. Dragging it across the floor, he brings it to the spread-out shower curtain and lays it down. He sees bloodstains on his trembling hands. Returning to the bathroom, he goes to the sink and washes them. The blood runs down the open drain, diluted in the water. Norman wipes a spot of blood off the porcelain basin, carefully removing every trace. He shakes the excess water off his hands, then wipes them on the lapels of his corduroy blazer and leans down to the shower nozzle. Using the mop, he cleans the residual streaks of blood out of the tub. He works with cool efficiency. Next, he swabs the outside of the tub, Marion's shoes resting on the tiles nearby. He methodically works his way across the bathroom floor. His mop streaks and dilutes the deep red blood until it seeps into the grout. Norman leans the mop against a corner. He grabs a hand towel off a rack, then reaches for the shower nozzle again. He goes over the cleaned floor with the towel, carefully drying the tiles. He wipes around the perimeter of the toilet bowl. He then dumps the towel inside the pail and lays the mop on top. Stepping carefully around the unseen body, he goes out into the bedroom. He crosses to the door and exits to the porch. He makes his way into Marion's car from the passenger door. He slides across the front seat to the key in the ignition. Driving slowly, he makes a three-point turn and backs the car up as close as he can to the porch just in front of cabin one. He steps out of the used car and goes to the trunk. Opening it with the key, he leaves the lid raised. He goes back into Marion's room. Norman bends down and begins to wrap the shower curtain around the unseen body. He delicately raises the edges and folds them down again, making a tight bundle. He then picks up the wrapped body in his arms and carries it out the open door. Crossing the porch, he deposits the unwieldy corpse in the car's trunk. Closing the lid most of the way, he turns back to the room, checking cautiously in all directions. Going inside, he closes the door and switches on the lights. He finds the room key on the shag carpet and pockets it. Outside the bathroom, he picks up the bird painting and hangs it back in its place on the wall. He picks up some of Marion's belongings off the floor and the dresser. Going into the bathroom, he checks around for all traces of the motel guest. With her robe and shoes in one hand, he picks up the mop and pail in the other and comes back into the bedroom. Setting down the mop and pail, he packs the other items into Marion's suitcase and zips it shut. Leaving the folded newspaper behind on the nightstand, he picks up the suitcase, crosses to the light switch, and turns it off again. He opens the door. Holding the suitcase in one hand and the mop and pail in the other, He looks around cautiously before proceeding outside, where a passing headlight flashes across him. Norman instinctively sets down his things and stands frozen on the porch, smiling nervously as he watches the car go by. Gathering the items back up, he raises the lid on the car trunk with his foot. He throws the suitcase inside, then fits in the mop and pail. Lowering the trunk lid again, he goes back inside the open motel room. His eye is caught by the newspaper on the bedside table. He goes and grabs it, turns out the light in the bathroom, and crosses back out onto the porch in the dark, pulling the door shut behind him. Tossing the newspaper in the trunk, he closes it, then goes around to the driver's side of the car and gets in behind the wheel. Pulling out in the dark, leaving his headlights off, he turns past the L-shaped cabins of motel rooms. Later, lights shine down from the closed trunk onto the car's California license plate NFB418 as it rolls slowly forward into the edge of a swamp. It stops, and Norman gets out. Releasing the parking brake, he closes the door and pushes the car down an incline into the swamp water. Norman eats some candy as he watches it slowly sink into the quagmire. It stops, with the illuminated trunk and taillights still above the surface. Norman stops chewing his candy. He looks around nervously in all directions. The sinking proceeds at a snail's pace. With a relieved smile, Norman puts another piece of candy in his mouth. The water bubbles above the car as the rest of it finally gets swallowed up by the swamp, leaving no trace. Norman's smile broadens as he chews. Now, under letterhead reading Loomis Hardware, Fairvale, California, Sam writes, December 18th, 98, "Dearest, right as always, Marion, I'm sitting in this tiny back room which isn't big enough for both of us, and suddenly it looks big enough for both of us. So what if we're poor and cramped and miserable? At least we'll be happy. If you haven't come to your senses and still want to give us a try, I'll be, meanwhile, at the front counter."
They tell you what the ingredients are and how it's guaranteed to exterminate any insect in the world, but they do not tell you whether or not it's painless. I believe, insect or man, death should always be painless.
Wow.
A red-haired woman wearing a backpack exits a cab and walks purposefully inside the hardware store. Lowering the headphones of her portable cassette player to around her neck, she approaches the counter.
Sam?
Sam, is a lady here for you?
The elderly customer purchases her can of insecticide as Sam comes out from the back room through a beaded curtain.
Yes, miss.
I'm Marion's sister.
Lila.
Is Marion here?
Of course not. Is something wrong?
She left home on Friday. I was in Tucson over the weekend, and I haven't heard from her, not even a phone call. Look, if you two are in this together, I don't care. It's none of my business. But I want to talk to Marion, and I want her to tell me it's none of my business, and then I'll go!
Bob, run out and get yourself some lunch.
Oh, that's okay. I bought it with me.
Run out and eat it.
Bob takes the hint. A man in an ill-fitting suit and hat enters the store.
Now, what thing have we been on together?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to yell at you.
Is Marion trouble, or what is it?
Let's all talk about Marion, shall we?
He saunters up to the pair.
Who are you, friend? My name's Arbogast, friend. I'm a private investigator.
He flashes his ID.
Where is she, Miss Crane?
I don't know you.
I know you don't. If you did, I wouldn't be able to follow you.
What's your interest in this?
$400,000.
$400,000.
That's right.
You better tell me what's going on here and tell me fast. I can take just so much of this.
Take it easy, friend. Just take it easy. Your girlfriend stole $400,000.
What are you talking about? What is this?
She was supposed to bank it on Friday for her boss. She didn't. No one has seen her since.
Oh, someone's seen her. Someone always sees a girl with $400,000.
Sam, they don't want to prosecute. They just want the money back. So if she's here, would you tell us?
She's not. She isn't. She ain't here.
Miss Crane, can I ask you a question? Did you come all the way up here on a hunch and nothing more?
Not even a hunch, just hope.
You know, with a little checking, I could get to believe you.
I don't care if you believe me or not. All I want to do is find Marion before she gets into this too deeply.
Yeah, did you check in Phoenix? In the hospital? Maybe she had an accident. Or a holdup.
No, she was seen leaving town in her car by her employer, I might add.
Well, I can't believe it.
He looks to Lila.
And you?
Well, you know, we're always quickest to doubt people who have a record for being honest. I think she's here, Miss Crane, where there's a boyfriend. Well, she's not back there with the nuts and bolts, but she's here in this town. Somewhere. I'll find her.
Later, Arbogast interviews managers at hotels, B&Bs, and boarding houses throughout town. He shows one proprietor a photograph of Marion. At the Bates Motel, Norman sits in a chair on the office porch, eating a bag of candy while he reads a magazine. Looking up, he closes the magazine and rises from his chair. Arbogast pulls up in front of him in his car. He slides out through the passenger door.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Almost drove right past.
Yeah, I'm always forgetting to turn the sign on. But we do have a vacancy. 12, in fact. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies. Some candy?
No, thanks. Last 2 days, I've been to so many motels, my eyes are bleary with the neon. But you know, this is the first one that looks like it's hiding from the world.
Well, to tell you the truth, I didn't really forget to turn the sign on. It just doesn't seem like much use anymore. You know? That used to be the main highway right over there. Want to come in and register?
No. Sit down. Don't want to trouble you. Just want to ask you some questions.
No trouble at all. Today's linen day. I change the beds here once a week, whether they've been used or not. I just hate the smell of dampness, you know? Such a, kind of a creepy smell. Come on.
Arbogast follows him into the office.
You out to buy a motel?
No.
The reason I asked is because you said you've seen so many in the past couple days. I thought maybe you, what was it you wanted to ask me?
Looking for a missing person. My name's Arbogast. I'm a private investigator.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to trace a girl that's been missing for, about a week now.
Mm-hmm.
From Phoenix. It's a private matter. And family wants to forgive her. Mm. She's not in any trouble.
I didn't think the police went looking for people who aren't in any trouble.
Oh, I'm not the police.
Oh, yeah. Private investigator.
We have reason to believe she came along this way. Might have stopped in the area.
He takes out his photo.
She stopped here?
No one stopped here for a couple weeks.
You mind looking at the picture before committing yourself?
Commit myself? You sure sound like a policeman.
Look at the picture, please.
He takes a glance.
Mm-mm.
You're sure?
Yeah.
Well, it's possible she used an alias. Marion Crane is her real name, but she could have registered under a different one.
You know, I don't even bother registering people anymore. One by one, you sort of drop the formalities. I shouldn't even be changing the sheets, but old habits die hard. Oh, which reminds me.
He flips a switch.
What's that?
The lights. The sign. You had a couple last week said if it hadn't been on, they would have driven right past. It looked like an old deserted...
Now, you see, that's exactly my point. You said nobody had been here for a couple of weeks. Now there's this couple came by and...
Yeah?
They didn't know you were open.
Yeah?
Well, as you say, old habits die hard. It's possible this girl registered under a different name. Could I look at your book?
Hmm?
Thanks.
No.
I've got the date here somewhere.
See, there's no one there.
Got a sample of her handwriting.
Norman cranes his neck to watch him compare it to the registration book, his jugular flexing as he chews.
Oh, yeah, here we are. Marie Samuels, that's an interesting alias.
Is that her?
Yeah, I think so. Marie, Marion, Samuels, her boyfriend's name is Sam. Was she in disguise by any chance? You want to look at the picture again?
Now look, Mr. Arbogast, I'm not lying to you. It's just that...
No. I know that. I know you wouldn't lie.
It's just, it's hard to keep track of time around here.
Oh, I know.
He holds up the photograph of Marion again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
Well, it was raining that night and her hair was all wet. And I'll tell you, it's not a very good picture of her either.
No, I guess not.
At all.
I guess not.
Uh-uh.
Tell me all about her.
Well, she arrived rather late one night and went to sleep and left early in the morning.
How early?
Very early.
Which morning was this?
The next day, so Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Did anyone meet her here?
Oh.
Did she arrive with anyone?
Nope.
Did she make any phone calls or, locally?
Uh-uh.
Would you spend the night with her?
No.
Well, then how do you know she didn't make any phone calls?
Well, we, she was very tired, and I'm starting to remember it now. I'm making a, mental, picture of it in my mind. Do you know how you do that? How you make a mental picturization of something in your mind?
That's right. Take your time. Okay.
She was, she was sitting back there. She was standing back there, and she had a sandwich in her hand, and she said that she had a long drive ahead of her, so she went to bed, straight to bed.
Back where?
Back from where she came from.
You said before she was sitting or standing back there?
Yes, in my parlor back there. Yeah, she said she was very hungry. So I made her a sandwich, and she said she was tired, and she went straight to sleep.
Oh, I see. How'd she pay you? A check? Cash?
Cash.
Oh, cash, huh? Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
After she left, she didn't come back.
Why would she?
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's about it, Mr. Arbogast. So, I got some work to do, if you don't mind.
Well, to tell you the truth, I do mind. If it don't gel, it ain't jello. And this just ain't gelling. It's not coming together somehow. Something's missing.
I don't know what else you could expect me to know. I mean, people just come and go and...
That's right. She's not still here, is she?
No.
If I wanted to check the cabins, all 12 of them, would I need a warrant for that?
Look, if you don't believe me, come with me. You can help me change the beds if you like.
No, thanks.
They both exit to the porch, turning in different directions. Arbogast notices Norman hesitating outside cabin one and proceeding to the next room instead. Putting on his fedora, the PI turns to the end of the porch and looks up at the old house on the hill. He sees a person silhouette in the upstairs window. Norman crosses to him.
Change your mind? You know, I must have one of those faces you just can't help believing.
Is anyone at home?
No.
Oh, there's someone sitting up in the window.
No, there isn't.
Oh, sure. Go ahead. Take a look.
Oh, that's my mother. She's an invalid.
An invalid.
It's practically like living alone.
Oh, I see. If this girl, Marion Crane, were here, you wouldn't be hiding her, would you? Not even if she paid you a lot of money?
No.
Well, let's just say for the sake of argument that she wanted you to gallantly protect her. You'd know you were being used. You wouldn't be made a fool of, would you?
I'm not a fool. I'm not capable of being made a fool.
I know.
Not even by a woman.
It's not a slur on your manhood. I'm sorry.
Let's just put it this way. She might have made a fool out of me, but she didn't fool my mother.
Well, then your mother met her? Could I talk to your mother?
As I just told you, she's confined.
Yeah, but just for a few minutes. That's all. You know, there might be some hint that you overlooked. You know, sick old women are usually pretty sharp.
Mr. Arbogast, I explained to you now
just for a moment. I wouldn't disturb her.
I think I've talked to you all that I want to.
Yes, but just for one moment.
So I think it would be much better if you left now.
Okay. You know, you'd save me a lot of legwork if you'd just let me talk to her about... Do I need a warrant for that, too?
Sure.
All right. Thanks anyway.
Arbogast heads to his car. Still holding his fresh linens, Norman takes a seat on the windowsill and watches him. Arbogast's headlights sweep across the porch, spotlighting the tall young man for a moment. As they go on their way, a grin appears on Norman's face. Later, at a roadhouse, Arbogast gets out of his car and enters a telephone booth. Lifting the receiver off the switch hook, he drops a coin in the slot and dials a number on the touchpad.
Oh, hello, Loomis. It's Arbogast. Is Lila there? Can I talk to her, please? Hello, Lila. Lila, listen, Marion was up here. Yep, she spent last Saturday night at the Bates Motel. It's out here on the old highway. I even know what cabin she was in, cabin number one. Well, the young fellow that runs the place said she just spent the night, left the next day. That was it. No, not exactly. Well, I did question him, believe me. I think I got all there was to get. I'll just have to pick up the pieces from here. Well, I'll tell you, I don't feel entirely satisfied. See, this boy has a sick old mother. I think she saw Marion and talked to her. No, unfortunately, he wouldn't let me see her. Well, I think I'll go back to the motel first. No, you stay there with Loomis. I'll be back in an hour. All right.
As he hangs up, the image dissolves back to the Bates Motel with the view of the house in the distance, the lights still on in the upstairs windows and front entryway. Norman emerges from his office and moves along the porch with an armful of sheets. He pauses partway, peering out from underneath the shadowy canopy, then continues toward the far cabins. Arbogast's car drives up and stops in the front parking lot. The PI slides across his front seats and gets out from the passenger side door. He crosses the lot to the motel office, its windows lit from within. Stepping up to the porch, he goes in the office.
Bates?
He cranes his neck to peer over the front desk toward the parlor. Stepping around to the doorway, he stops short as he sees a taxidermied bird mounted on a log. His eyes scan the parlor, noting some golf clubs against a wall, then discover an old safe on the floor with its door slightly ajar. He swings it the rest of the way open with his foot and checks inside to find it empty. He looks up disappointedly. Closing the door back to where it was, he straightens up and turns out of the room. Making his way out of the motel office, he glances down the row of cabins, then turns the other way with a thoughtful look on his face. From the edge of the porch, he peers up at the old house. He glances over his shoulder once more before decisively going forward toward the jagged set of stairs. He makes his way up the stone steps at a slow clip toward the dark and gloomy house. Reaching the top, he proceeds past an overgrown patch of weeds and heads up onto the stoop. The house remains dark, except for the upstairs window and the front door. Arbogast glances back down toward the motel before doffing his hat and turning the knob. He steps inside to the foyer. Looking up the stairs, he sees a closed door at the top as he eases the front door shut behind him. He waits there a moment. Taking a couple steps forward, he peers down the hall alongside the staircase. His eyes return to the closed door upstairs, then settle briefly on a bronze statue of Cupid to his side. He crosses to the stairs and starts up. Proceeding at a deliberate pace, he remains on edge, his head on a swivel, as he gets further and further from the foyer. Meanwhile, a door opens slowly, spilling out a sliver of light. As Arbogast reaches the landing, a blonde-haired figure steps out in a silk robe, slashing with her enormous knife. Images flash, a woman lying on her side wearing only black panties and an eye mask, a windshield closing in on a cow that stands on a rainy road. His face cut from forehead to cheek, the PI stumbles off balance, the foyer closing in rapidly behind him as he falls all the way down the length of the stairs. Mrs. Bates pounces, stabbing him again. At the hardware store.
Sometimes Saturday night has a lonely sound. You ever notice that, Lyle?
Sam, please. He said an hour or less.
Sam checks his watch.
Yeah. Been three.
Are we just gonna sit here and wait?
He'll be back. Sit still. Hang on.
Lila gets up and walks toward him.
How far is it to the old highway?
You want to go out there, don't you? Bust in on Arbogast, the old lady. Maybe scare her a little bit?
Yeah.
Wouldn't be a wise thing to do.
Impatience doesn't run in my family, Sam. I'm going out there.
Arbogast said
an
just...
hour or less.
Right. I'll call out there.
Sam goes to the phone on his desk, Lila puts on her backpack.
Well, I'm going.
Sam puts the phone down.
You'll never find it.
Lila.
What?
I'll go. You stay here.
Why can't I go with you?
I don't know. One of us has to be here in case he's on the way.
What am I supposed to do? Just sit here and wait?
Yeah.
He kisses her on the cheek.
Have another beer.
Lila stares after him as he exits. A breeze from outside ruffles her red hair. Her lonely form dissolves away to a spindly branch growing out of the swamp, where the solitary figure of Norman stands looking out upon the still waters. At the motel, Sam pokes around outside the office.
Mr. Arbogast!
Back in the swamp. Slowly, Norman turns his head from the murky pool of water and peers back in the direction of the motel, shadows and light accentuating his pale, gloomy features. At the hardware store, Lila runs out from the back room in the dark as Sam returns.
You come back here?
Tim.
No Arbogast, no Bates. Only the old lady at home. Sick old lady unable to answer the door. Or unwilling.
Where could he have gone?
Maybe he got a definite lead. Maybe he went right on ahead and...
Without calling me?
In a hurry.
Oh, Sam, he called when he had nothing. Nothing but a dissatisfied feeling. Don't you think he would have called if he had anything at all?
Yeah, I think he would have. Let's go see Al Chambers.
Who's he?
Their deputy sheriff around here.
Let me get my Walkman.
Later, with an old couple wearing bathrobes over their nightclothes.
Now, your sister's been missing how long?
She left Phoenix a week ago yesterday without a trace.
How'd you and this detective come to trace her to Fairvale?
They thought that she'd be coming to me.
Left Phoenix under her own steam?
Yeah.
And she's not missing so much as she's run away.
Yeah, that's right.
From what?
She stole some money.
A lot?
$400,000.
And the police haven't been able to...
Everyone concerned thought that if they could get her to give the money back, they could avoid involving her with the police.
Explains the private detective. Traced it to the Bates place. What exactly did he say when he called you?
He said that Marion stayed there for one night and then she left.
With the $400,000?
He didn't say anything about the money. It's not important what he said on the phone. Is it he's supposed to come back and talk to us after he talked to the mother, and he didn't. That's what I want you to do something about.
Like what?
I'm sorry if I seem over-anxious, just that something is wrong out there, and I have to know what.
Well, I think there's something wrong, too, miss, but not the same thing. I think what's wrong is your private detective. I think he got a hot lead as to where your sister was going, probably from Norman Bates. He called you to keep you still while he took off after your sister and the money.
No, he said he was dissatisfied and he was going back there.
Why don't you call Norman and just let him say what happened?
Sheriff Chambers nods, and his wife goes to a telephone on a small desk.
Flory, the sheriff wants you to connect him with the Bates Motel.
She hands the receiver to her husband.
Norman? Sheriff Chambers. I've been just fine, thanks. Listen, we got worries here. Did you have a fellow stop out there tonight? No, this one wouldn't be a customer anyway. It's a private detective, name of...
Arbogast.
Arbogast. And after he left? No, that's okay, Norman. Well, this detective was there. Norman told him about the girl. The detective thanked him, went away.
He didn't come back? Didn't see the mother?
He shares a look with his wife.
Your detective told you that he couldn't come back right away because he wanted to question Norman Bates' mother, is that right?
Yeah.
Norman Bates' mother has been dead and buried in Green Lawn Cemetery for the past 10 years.
I helped Norman pick out the dress she was buried in. Periwinkle blue.
It ain't only local history, Sam. It's the only case of murder and suicide on the Fairvale ledgers. Mrs. Bates poisoned this guy she was involved with when she found out he was married. Then she took a helping of the same stuff herself. Strychnine. Ugly way to die.
Norman found them dead together. In bed.
You mean that old woman I saw sitting in... The window out there is not Norman Bates' mother?
Just a minute, Sam. Are you sure you saw an old woman?
Yeah. In the house behind the motel. I mean, I
call and pound it, but she just ignored me.
Well, if the woman up there is Mrs. Bates, who's that woman buried out in Greenlawn Cemetery?
Meanwhile, Norman removes his telephone from his lap and sets it aside in the motel parlor. Chewing, he rises from an upholstered chair, turns off the light switch, and crosses through the office. Outside, he jogs up the steps to the house, its upstairs bedroom lights aglow. Opening the door, he goes inside and makes a beeline to the stairs. He ascends to the top, where he makes a left turn, disappearing behind the balusters, and opens his mother's door. The view from downstairs slowly creeps upwards, passing above a glass display of stuffed birds, then twists and bends to a downward-facing angle over the landing.
Mother, I have to take you downstairs.
I am sorry, boy, but you do manage to look ludicrous when you give me orders.
Please, Mother.
No, I will not hide in the fruit cellar. Think I'm fruity, huh? I'm staying right here. This is my room, and no one will drag me out of it. Least of all my big, bold son.
They'll come now, Mother. He came after the girl, and now some will come after him. Mother, please. It's just for a few days. Just for a few days, so they don't find you.
Just for a few days? In that tank fruit cellar? No, you hit me there once, boy, and you won't do it again. Get out. Norman. What do you think you're going to do? Don't you touch me. Don't put me down, and I'll walk on my own.
Norman comes out, holding his shriveled mother in his arms, and carries her down the stairs. In the morning, Sam drives Lila in his truck.
Guess we better decide what we're going to say and do when we walk in there. No?
We're going to register as man and wife, and then we're going to get shown to a cabin. We're going to search every inch of that place, inside and out.
They pull into the empty lot outside the Bates Motel. At the house, Norman raises a window shade and stares down at them. Sam heads for the office, leaving the lone figure of Lila standing by the truck. Norman leans on the window sash, studying her. As her head turns toward the house, he pulls the shade down. Sam comes out of the motel office.
Oh, I wonder where Norman Bates does his hermiting.
In the window, I just saw something move.
Norman flounces down the steps.
Well, hey, we were just coming up to ring for you.
Suppose you want a room?
Yeah, we were going to try to make it all the way to San Francisco, but we don't like the look of that sky. It's like a bad day coming up.
Okay.
He saunters into the office and takes a room key down from the board as Sam and Lila reach the desk counter.
Take it, Captain 10.
Better sign in first, hadn't we?
Oh, no, it isn't necessary.
No, my boss paying for this trip, and it's 90% business, so well, it's practically notarized receipts. I think we better sign and get a receipt.
Norman brings out the registration book, opens it to the current page, and hands him a pen. Lila winks at the proprietor as Sam signs in. Norman winks back.
All right. I'll get your bags.
Haven't any.
Well, I'll show you your room then.
First time I ever seen that happen. You check in any place in this country without a bag, you have to pay in advance.
$36.50.
Ready?
Sam pays him.
Ready?
That receipt.
Lila takes the key.
I go on ahead.
Stepping out to the porch, she tries the door to cabin one and finds it unlocked.
See? Now I'll show you the cabin.
That's okay. Go by yourself. We'll find it.
Sam catches up with Lila, making her way to their room. Norman stands by the office door, staring after them. He watches Sam slide his arm around Lila's shoulders, then withdraw it as she gives him a terse look. As they reach their cabin, number 10, Norman turns and walks away around the side of the motel. Sam and Lila go inside, shutting the door behind them. Sam sits down on the bed and takes off his cowboy hat.
We gotta go in there and search that cabin, Sam. No matter what we're afraid of finding or how much it may hurt.
I know. You think if something happened here?
I don't know. If he you had a useless business like this motel, what would it take to get out, get a new business someplace else? $400,000?
Well, how can we prove that?
And there's got to be some proof that exists right now, something that proves that he got that money away from Marion somehow.
Sam removes his vintage Western-style jacket.
I guess you sound so certain.
Arbogast. He liked me, Sam. He felt sorry for me. He was starting to feel the same way about you. I could tell the last time I talked to him on the phone. He wouldn't have gone anywhere or done anything without telling us, unless he was stopped. And he was stopped, so he must have found out something.
Huh? Start with Cabin 1.
Sam rises into action. Lila exits the cabin ahead of him. Sam closes the door and walks behind her as they stroll around the bend in the porch, following the descending numbers on the motel room doors. Near cabin 7, they step up to a higher section of the covered walkway. As they reach cabin 1, Sam gives Lila's arm a squeeze, signaling her to wait. He goes on ahead to the office, popping inside the open door.
Bates.
Sam disappears from view for a moment before coming back out and returning to Lila, who opens the door of cabin 1. As they enter the room together, she turns on a flashlight. They begin to search around, Lila starting with the closet alcove. Sam checks the drawers in the desk and the vanity table. Lila kneels to search the dresser. Sam moves past her around the bed to check out the nightstand, but finds only a Bible in the drawer. Finished examining the dresser, Lila opens the bathroom door and switches on the light. Sam follows her in. While she crouches to the toilet and opens its lid, his eye catches on the shower curtain rod, which holds a series of empty rings.
No shower curtain.
Sam, look.
What is it?
Figuring. Didn't get washed down. Look, some figure's been added to or subtracted from 400,000. Proof Marion was here is too wild a coincidence.
Oh, wait a minute. Bates never denied she was here.
Oh. Doesn't it prove you found out about the money?
Do we ask where he's hidden it?
No. That old woman, whoever she told Arbogast something. I want her to tell us the same thing.
Well, you can't go up there.
Why not?
Bates.
Well, let's find him. One of us can keep him occupied, and the other one can get the old woman.
You won't be able to hold him still if he doesn't want to be held. I don't like you going up in that house alone, Lila.
I can handle a sick old woman.
All right. I'll find Bates and keep him occupied.
Sam opens the cabin door wide enough to stick his body through and look around. Lila sidles out in front of him, and he eases the door shut. They exchange a glance, then Sam heads past the office, where Norman stands waiting.
Looking for me?
Yeah, matter of fact. Wife's taking a nap, and I can never keep quiet enough for her, so thought maybe I'd look you up and talk.
Good. Satisfied with your cabin?
Oh, it's fine.
He subtly waves to Lila down the long porch as he starts into the office. She slips through a small alley between the rows of cabins to the back of the motel. Eyeing the house up on the hill, she moves forward past a junk pile of old mattresses. She ascends a dirt path up the steep hill, moving purposefully. As she draws nearer, she gets a better look at the eclectic, half-brick, half-cement house through the weeds in the front yard. Her mouth hangs slightly agape, accentuated by her deep red lipstick. She comes to a stop, eyes narrowed resolutely as they scan the gabled upper floors. Proceeding ahead, she mounts the front steps. Reaching the door, she looks inside through its slender inlaid windows, then turns the knob and pushes it open.
Mrs. Bates?
You're alone here, aren't you?
In the motel office.
Drive me crazy.
That'd be a rather extreme reaction, don't you think?
Well, it's just an expression. What I meant was, I'd do just about anything, get away. Wouldn't you?
How?
Meanwhile.
Mrs. Bates?
Lila reaches the top of the stairs and turns to Mother's room.
Mrs. Bates?
She opens the door and passes through the threshold into a quaintly decorated room. The polished wood furnishings include a queen-sized bed with a thick headboard and footboard and a dresser holding crystal candlesticks. A painting of a tree-lined road hangs above the bed. Lila pauses to look around near a bronze statue of the Greek god Hermes. Stepping past an antique chair with an upholstered seat, she goes to a high wardrobe with a mirror door. She opens it to find an ample collection of dated dresses hanging on the rack inside. Closing the wardrobe, she turns and continues her exploration of the room. A lacy table runner drapes across a dressing table lined with beauty supplies and a ceramic bird. Lila takes a closer look at a pair of crossed hands in bronze, then lifts her eyes toward the vanity mirror. She wheels around to find her reflection duplicated in the mirror door of the wardrobe, then notices an imprint of a curled-up body on the bed. She runs her hand along the indentation. Meanwhile,
I'm not saying that you shouldn't be contented here. I'm just doubting that you are. I think if you saw a chance to get out from under, you'd unload this place.
This place? This place happens to be my only world. See, I grew up in that house up there, and I had a very happy childhood. My mother and me were more than happy.
Back in the Bates house, Lila makes her way inside an attic bedroom. A BB rifle hangs mounted on the wall near an archer's bow and a powder horn. Lila studies the room, her eyes alighting on a stuffed giraffe leaning against the headboard of a small bed with rumpled sheets and green army men scattered over books and board games. A black and white photograph hanging on a wall shows a bird handler holding two owls. Lila crosses to a record player to find a 45 of The World Needs a Melody by George Jones and Tammy Wynette on the turntable. Reaching down to a bookshelf, she pulls out an adult magazine and flips through the pages of Naked Women. Back at the motel office.
You seem frightened. Am I saying something frightening?
I don't know what you're saying.
I'm talking about your mother, about your motel.
Norman puts a magazine away on a rack.
How are you gonna do it?
Do what?
Buy a new one, new town. Where you won't have to hide your mother.
Why don't you just get in your car and drive away from here, okay?
Where are you gonna get that kind of money? Or do you already have it somewhere?
Shut up!
Huh? A lot of it. $400,000. But your mother knows where it is. What you did to get it.
Where's that girl that you came here with?
Meanwhile, Lila leaves Norman's room.
I bet she'll tell us.
Norman picks up a golf club. In the house, Lila starts downstairs. Now, Norman strikes Sam in the head with the club, knocking him out. Lila stops short on the stairs as she sees Norman running up outside a window. She hurries down to the hallway in a panic and conceals herself on another stairway leading down to the basement just as he enters the house. He glances about briefly before running upstairs. Looking up toward the main staircase above her, Lila follows the sound with her eyes. She notes a cellar door at the bottom of her set of stairs. She goes down to it. Stepping through, she snaps on an overhead light bulb in the dark brick-walled cellar, then walks past some storage items, including chemical jugs. She opens another set of doors, revealing a larger room, and flips an old-fashioned switch on the outside. Fluorescent lights flicker on. Lila walks into a sterile, highly organized taxidermy workshop and sees a frail woman seated beyond some curtains, facing a giant glass cage of birds.
Mrs. Bates?
She touches the old woman's shoulder, causing the chair to swivel around and reveal a mummified corpse. A spider crawls out of the mouth and up the leathery face. Lila's hand flails, smacking a lamp hanging overhead. Norman, wearing a white blonde wig and a woman's silk robe, slowly comes downstairs after her and raises the knife. Sam bashes him on the back of the head with a pot. Struggling over the knife, they crash into a glass case. Norman's wig falls off as Sam pulls him to the floor. Lila comes over and kicks him in the face as he scrambles for the dropped knife. The swinging light sweeps its glow around the room as Sam restrains Norman. Lila looks down at his wig lying on the floor. The shifting shadows animate the ghoulish, full-toothed face of Mrs. Bates until it dissolves away to a view of the Victoria County Courthouse at night. Inside, a balding man in a nice shirt and slacks carries a coffee mug to a doorway, which a police officer lets him into. He sits across from Norman in a white-walled detention room.
So, Norman.
Elsewhere.
If anybody can get any answers, it'll be the psychiatrist. Even I couldn't get to Norman, and he knows me.
He looks at Lila.
You warming up, miss?
She nods. The psychiatrist comes in.
Did he talk to you?
No. I got the whole story, but not from Norman. I got it from his mother. Norman Bates no longer exists. He only half existed to begin with. Now, the other half is taken over. Probably for all time.
Did he kill my sister?
Yes. Sorry. The private investigator, too. If you drag the swamp in the vicinity of the motel, to understand it, as I understood it, hearing it from the mother, that is the mother half of Norman's mind, you have to go back 10 years to the time when Norman murdered his mother and her lover. He was already dangerously disturbed, had been ever since his father died. His mother was a clinging, demanding woman, and for years they lived as if there was no one else in the world. Then she found a man, and it seemed to Norman that she threw him over for this man. That pushed him over the thin line, and he killed them both. So, he had to erase the crime, at least in his mind. He stole her corpse, and a weighted coffin was buried. He hid the body in the fruit cellar and treated it to keep it as well as it would keep. And that still wasn't enough. She was there, but she was a corpse. So he began to think and speak for her. At times, he could be both personalities, carry on conversations. At other times, the mother half took over completely. He was never all Norman. But he was often only mother. When he met your sister, he was touched by her and aroused by her. He wanted her. This set off his jealous mother. And mother killed the girl. Whenever reality came too close, when danger or desire threatened that illusion, he'd dress up, even to a cheap wig he'd bought. And he'd walk about the house, sit in her chair, speak in her voice. He tried to be his mother. And now he is.
And the $400,000, who got that?
The swamp. These are crimes of passion, not profit.
A policeman peeks in.
He feels a little chill. Can I bring him this blanket?
Sure.
All right.
The policeman nods and exits. He moves down a corridor, past other cops and reporters, to the guard posted by the detention room, who opens the door for him and lets him inside with the blanket. He unfolds it as he crosses the stark white room, then hands it off.
Thank you.
The policeman looks back over his shoulder as he returns to the door. Norman wears the blanket like a shawl, keeping his mouth shut tight.
It's sad. When a mother has to speak the words that condemn her own son. But I couldn't allow them to believe that I would commit murder. They'll put him away now, as I should have years ago. He was always bad. And in the end, he intended to tell them that I killed those girls and that man. As if I could do anything except just sit and stare like one of his stuffed birds. Well, they know I can't even move a finger. And I won't. I'll just sit here and be quiet, just in case they do suspect me. They're probably watching me. Well, let them see what kind of a person I am. I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they are watching.
Probably watching.
They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
His smiling face appears skeletal as it dissolves away to a chain towing Marion's car out of the swamp. It hits a snag. It finally comes loose and rolls past police officers and coroner's men searching the swamp water and the adjacent grounds. Credits roll. The ground-level view of the recover effort rises up to reveal more authorities aiding in the search. Two policemen comb through the bushes with their nightsticks. Used car gets towed off. The coroner's men and highway patrol officers walk to their parked vehicles. The coroner's van drives off. The highway patrol car follows. Another officer heads to his squad car, the search team dwindling. The elevated view of the crime scene continues to rise, gradually revealing more and more of the swamp. A blue truck with a light bar on its roof rolls past the squad car. With no one left in sight, the now panoramic view of the surrounding hillside reveals tiny cars zipping by on a distant highway. The procession of police vehicles rolls back into view at the far side of the swamp. Following a dirt road, the cars disappear for good among the trees and hills. Copyright 1998, Universal City Studios, Inc., all rights reserved. Country of first publication, United States of America. Universal City Studios, Inc. is the author of this motion picture for purposes of the Berne Convention and all national laws giving effect thereto. The characters and events depicted in this photoplay are fictitious. Any similarity to actual persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental. This motion picture is protected under the laws of the United States and other countries. Unauthorized duplication, distribution, or exhibition may result in civil liability and criminal prosecution. In memory of Alfred Hitchcock, this film has been described by Deluxe with funding by Universal, voiced by William Michael Redman.